You're listening to Life in Deep Ellum's podcast.
Hey everyone, welcome to the podcast. This week I wanted to highlight that it is Pride Month. And to highlight that, I brought in a buddy of mine, Josh Kogan, a guy from our faith community. How you doing, Josh?
I'm doing well, Joel. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good, man. Tell us a little bit about your story. It's kind of a winding story. You start out in one place, and then you end up in a totally different place.
Absolutely. I'll give you the short version of where we want to start. But I'm from North Carolina originally. Mm-hmm. And in 2011, I graduated college, Gardner-Webb University, home of the Running Bulldogs.
Okay.
Yep.
Good to know.
There you go. And graduated with a degree in music composition. Moved out this direction, was living in Arlington at first, and went to Dallas Baptist University to get my master's in theological studies, but worship leadership emphasis. So during that time when I was in school, as you can imagine, if you have not maybe put the two pieces together with the DBU connection, I was of a more traditional conservative theology tradition, and being rooted in apologetics and just, you know, this theory of always having to have a biblical answer for every single question that you're presented in life, which now I understand is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But that was how I was trained. And so I was on staff at a First Baptist church in a rural town just south of here, and spent a couple years there on staff as minister of both music and youth. So
like being Pride Month, we're going to get to your kind of conversion of sorts, but... Mm-hmm. How would you have said your personal feelings were around issues of LGBTQ?
So we took the stance at the church that I was on staff at. This was around the time when we were talking about same-sex marriage as a nation, before the Obergefell ruling. And so North Carolina, my home state, was talking about voting on same-sex marriage. And my pastor, also boss, asked me to preach about homosexuality on that Sunday against it, and how it was an abomination. So that's where I came from.
Yep.
Wrote a Facebook post, and as you can imagine, because it's Facebook, that went super well.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So you then left that church to plant a church, right?
Correct. Here in Deep Ellum. So the short version of what led to that is what I did see at that church were other injustices. So I didn't realize at the time my both theology and philosophy were starting to unravel, but I didn't know it yet.
Gotcha.
Just simple things, or I say simple things, but for instance, in a staff meeting when the pastor would say, well, we're the church for our town. And I would say, well, demographically, we're 65% Hispanic in our town, and we're 98% white in our church.
Yeah.
So how are we the church for our town?
Yeah.
And that didn't go well either. So, but those were the kind of things that started to unravel for me, and wanted to start a church for folks who had just felt like they had been abandoned by the church or hurt by the church.
So. Yeah. And I remember those days, like we got connected through a different network, and I remember walking around Deep Ellum doing like prayer walks over the community, and of course you were super honoring of Rachel and I, and since we've been here so long, and you started developing relationships in the community and going about it in really the right way, and started even getting to know people that I didn't even know, and one of those organizations you ran across, you pointed out to me while we were on a prayer walk, called UBE. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, United Black Element is a program of resource centers. So resource center, not to be redundant, but is the LGBTQ resource center for North Texas. So they have all sorts of programs and services and advocacy for the LGBTQ community at large in North Texas. And so United Black Element, even though they are now at Resource Center's new building on Cedar Springs, at the time they were in the neighborhood in their own, in their own little building up on Hall Street, and just got to know Jelinski, who was the program director at the time. And I'll never forget it. There was one week where I was still with church planting, still connected to the Baptist Convention, and there was a Tuesday at the Baptist Convention where I felt as if, you know, I was kind of the black sheep of my colleagues, and was treated that way. And then on Wednesday, I'm over here with these folks at United Black Element, and the program is specifically for same gender loving black men and trans women of color. And we were all watching Empire. I'd been invited, and that was kind of my rule, was if you're invited, you just go. And we were watching Empire, eating spaghetti and ice cream, as you do. And during commercial break, it felt like I was the only one left in the room. Like, everybody got up to get more spaghetti or go to the bathroom. And I'm reading their poster, and I'm reading their mission statement, and it says, "We exist to serve black gay men and trans women of color ages 18 to 25. I was 27 at the time, straight, white, cisgender male, and I'm going, I shouldn't be loved in this space by this mission statement alone, and this feels like family." So that was a big, turning point for me.
And so that kind of launched you on this whole brand new journey. You ended up transitioning out of the church you were planting and taking on a whole new journey that was kind of prompted by an issue you discovered through youth homelessness.
So it was through the relationships at UBE that I was hearing the same theme in the story of, well, I got kicked out of my Christian home when I came out to my parents. And you know, initially it was just that shock of, I can't believe this happens. And then the questions started to snowball after that. And it's, okay, well, how widespread's the problem? Is this a Dallas issue? Is this national? Come to find it's national. And at the time, 2015, we were doing nothing in Dallas to address it. And around that same time, early 2016, I saw our councilman for the neighborhood, Adam Medrano's Facebook post saying, trying to figure out how to address LGBT youth homelessness. And by this point, I had been researching for 3-4 months. It was just on my heart that something needed to happen. And I didn't know what that, what that meant. And I saw the only cities that were doing anything at the time were more northern cities and West Coast and Northeast Coast, and no southern cities were doing anything yet. And so I started asking the question, why? And so then I was thinking back to my training and the Southern Bible Belt, if you will. And so I took a look through that lens of, what could we do that would push the boundaries but take our city with us? And that was what I presented to Councilman Medrano and said, here you go. I saw your post, and here's kind of my thoughts. And he looked at me and said, great, you're going to lead a team to address it. And I was like, what? I'm going to do what now?
And what I've really appreciated about your approach, Josh, you started an organization called Outlast Youth, and started focusing on this and getting involved with policy and getting to know the inner workings of the dysfunctional city system. And you really kept faith-based organizations at the forefront, because I think, correct me if I'm wrong, that you see that the problem has to involve, it needs to like bring as many people along as possible, whatever their theological position is on LGBTQ, you realize that there is space for people to still get involved in helping this particular issue of youth homelessness. That regardless of what people may believe about it, they can still help.
In those early days, you know, it has been and continues to be the foundation for me is that faith-based piece. Because even when you look at it from a statistical analysis standpoint, That's the leading cause of LGBTQ youth homelessness. So if we truly want to end LGBT youth homelessness as much as we can, you know, that's 75-80% of the issue. So if we can cut off that stream, then why wouldn't we do that? So we looked at that with faith-based peace. And so the early days, we wrote a statement that said, it doesn't matter what your theological belief on sexuality is, we believe together in this room that no youth should be homeless. And that was our foundation to do the hard work of bringing churches and church leaders who do disagree theologically together. And there would be some, usually more of a more progressive theology, who instantly gravitated towards us and said, how can we help in the work? And then with our folks that had more of a traditional theology, you know, that's taken time. 4 years later, now here we are, and we've we've got some folks coming to the table and saying, how do we have this conversation? So,
you know, we've been talking about on Sunday the issue of conversion, like Richard Rohr talks about there being five conversions to standing in solidarity with the poor, and he defines poor as any group of people that is seen as lesser than or marginalized by society. And he talks about the first conversion is when we begin to feel compassion, and I hear that in your story. The second conversion is when we start to feel like righteous indignation, like anger about, like, and I hear you saying like, oh, this is happening a lot, this shouldn't be happening. And then the third conversion is when we begin to see virtues in this community, and I hear you telling that in your story. You're sitting there feeling more belonging in this space where you, quote-unquote, shouldn't belong, yet in a space where you, quote-unquote, are seen as, you know, the mainstream, you felt a lot of tension in your in the faith-based stream you were in. The fourth conversion is when we kind of see past the individuals and we see the systems at play behind it that are churning out the suffering. And then lastly, the fifth conversion is standing in solidarity. So I'm just curious, where has this kind of led you in terms of the systems and standing in solidarity as an advocate for LGBTQ?
You know, that was really the, well, it was all difficult, right? Relatively. But that I would say in hindsight was the most difficult piece. So when I was sitting down with Councilman Medrano, that was kind of the turning point into the system, if you will. And I remember saying to him after he said, well, you're going to lead the team. I said, all due respect, sir. Like, I just, like, lost my job starting a church. And I know nothing about the LGBTQ community. Like, I'm a, as of recent, a former Baptist pastor. And he laughed. And I said, and I know nothing about homelessness other than it's just a problem. I'm like, I'm not the guy for this. And And I said, how am I supposed to come onto a city's LGBT task force as the straight guy who was the former Baptist pastor? And he said, well, yeah, we're going to have to talk about that. The first couple meetings, you just need to be quiet. So he was helping me with the system. And he has been, and he has the whole time. And so he's helped me navigate that system while still letting me stay focused on the issue at hand and listening to the stories and seeing how you can marry that data with the story to uncover the systemic issues and find solutions.
And you've done a lot of, I know you've been to Austin a lot, you're working with the city of Dallas's politics and the state politics. What are some of the systemic issues that you've run into and seen?
I think one that we worked on last session, that when I was talking to a lot of folks about it, it was just kind of that light bulb moment of not realizing, or I guess taking our own experiences for granted. And so a lot of folks don't know that it costs $16 for a state-issued ID. Like, we just don't think about that. We have our ID, but if you stopped and thought about how many uses you have for your ID. And I think in recent weeks, I mean, one way that you need your ID is if you get pulled over by police. And so for homeless youth out on the street who are experiencing homelessness, they probably don't have an ID. Mom and dad probably aren't like, or, you know, parent guardian aren't saying, hey, take your ID with you before you get out of this this house.
Yeah.
So, but then they probably don't have the $16 to buy the state issued ID. And if they do have the $16, food, well, I mean, there's other essentials. So the ID access bill that we were working on would have waived that $16 fee if you were homeless between the ages of 16 to 24 and you had a case manager.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. So, I mean, it's interesting to see these kind of issues and the dominoes they push over. What other issues have you seen?
Yeah, another one we did last session that kind of fell in our lap, and it was just through stories and, you know, being out and being in Deep Ellum and being in Dallas. It was put in our policy priority guide on first responder training for homeless interaction. So any first responder in the state of Texas would have mandatory training moving forward on how to interact with their homeless neighbor and how to ask the questions and get to the root of what they need rather than kind of the current system sometimes. And so that was last year. And it has been flagged in recent weeks by the House Democratic Caucus as a top priority for criminal justice reform for next session.
So helping these first responders really get to the root of issues rather than just...
You're homeless, you're drunk.
Go
to jail rather than saying what's going on.
A traumatic experience. And right now what is not needed is seeing you as a dangerous criminal.
And with the youth piece, it's so important because what happens a lot, especially with our youth curfew law ordinance in the city of Dallas, is there's just this assumption that if a teenager's out on the street, they're up to no good.
Yeah.
Rather than asking, well, why are you on the street? Yeah. Have you been kicked out? Do you have a place to go?
Yes.
It's asking those simple questions, but if you're not trained on it, then
you
don't know to ask the question.
Exactly. So, if you're only trained to use a hammer, everyone looks like a nail, right?
Correct.
One final question here, man, is, you know, you're, as you say, a straight white guy, and you're advocating in very diverse, you know, communities. And what would you say, and what have you heard people say, why does Pride Month matter?
Yeah, I was on a town hall yesterday, and someone asked me why Pride Month means... what Pride Month means to me as an ally, and I'll come back to that. But the statement that resonated was hearing my friend say, "Pride's the opposite of shame."
Oh man!
And, so like shame, just sitting in that,
like Pride means like I don't have to like hide and feel deep shame about this part of who I am.
Yeah, she and when she expounded on it, she shared a little bit about how that means. You know, it's individual, it's institutional. And what she talked about was this institutional shame and this systemic and societal shame that folks have put on the LGBTQ community, whether in our religious circles or our political circles, and that it still continues today. Yeah. And so just hearing that pride is the opposite of shame, just...
That resonates.
Yeah, it resonated.
I mean, who doesn't resonate with that?
Yeah. and my answer was for me as an ally, and it brings all of this full circle. I said, it used to mean nothing.
Yeah.
I didn't understand it. I said, and then folks in the LGBTQ community here became family. And then, so for me, pride is celebrating my family.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. So, man, I appreciate you coming along and sharing with us, and thanks for all the work you're doing, bro.
Absolutely. Thank you.